So, as promised, I turn the mic over to you. Oh, you have one over there already.
We have an audience mic here.
Excellent. So, great. So, I do not even have to prime you.
Nope. Well, I'm handling it.
Oh, okay. So, we have two mics here. Does anybody have a question? We have about 20 minutes.
Well, okay, since I have one, I'll ask a question for Catherine. That was a very interesting paper about the British struggle whether to naturalize French immigrants. In 1707, a group of very unusual French immigrants came to England. They were former Camisard rebels who were prophets, and they were known in England, as you presumably know, as the French prophets. It was a very controversial group of people who prophesied and ran afoul of the authorities in the English church. I'm wondering if there was any, in the debate over whether to naturalize French citizens in 1709, which is only 2 years later, whether that controversy played any role in that process.
That's an excellent question. I actually have not looked very much into that specific group in the context of 1709, so that would be a really interesting thing to get deeper into. What I can say is that a lot of the arguments for and against naturalization did tend to be really specific about the economic debates. As far as looking at the pamphlet discourse, and most of that was actually taking place in the 1680s and 1690s when the initial influx of Huguenots came into, well, England, but also a lot of them go to Ireland. So I think because of the kind of situation in 1680s, 1690s, that specific group wouldn't have influenced that set of pamphlet literature, obviously. But I'll have to look into if I can see if it does play into the one naturalization pamphlet that I have been able to find that was very much in conversation with the debate on the floor. So I'll just have to look into it. Thank you very much.
Well, there was a very good book published on it just a couple of years ago by Lionel Labarre.
Okay.
Called Enlightened Enthusiasms, and it's a kind of a fun book about that rather unusual group.
I'm looking forward to reading it. Thank you.
Actually, follow up for Catherine. How far forward do you anticipate taking that in terms of the broader project? Is this are you really just interested in? You mentioned you go backwards a little bit to 1680. How are you plan on going any further forward into the 18th century? And my work is on the French Revolutionary period, where I look at Corsica and the British take over Corsica, and there's actually some Corsican refugees that they're Catholic, right? And so it's just what do they do with them? So yeah, I was just wondering how if you were planned on situating it, sticking pretty early on in the 18th century, or stretching it even further beyond that.
That's a good question. I am writing proposals now, yeah. So the limits of my project are very much up in the air.
That's good.
I'm trying for my own sanity to keep it kind of 1685 to 1715, with maybe kind of a epilogue about the imperial context. So one thing that I didn't mention in this paper is that the naturalization bill actually ends up getting revived in the American colonies, and so it definitely has an afterlife there, and I think it would definitely be worth looking into maybe the... I might be willing to go up to like the mid-18th century, looking also, just taking into consideration in the arguments that I formulate what the long-term consequences are. So I will have to go and take into consideration Corsica. If you also have a book, I will take that.
I'll write it and get back to you.
Yes, write it.
No, it sounds like a great project, though. It really does.
Thank you so much for your
question. Well, maybe I'll... Oh, great. Beth, take it.
Thank you. I have, I guess, two questions that are perhaps selfishly oriented. I'm working on the botanist André Michaud, and so I'm interested in what you have to say about Le Sœur. One of the things that I've always been intrigued by in looking at Michaud's very not cryptic, but very simple journals of his voyages around around North America 40 years earlier are one when he encounters a French person. He notes it as he is traipsing around. He also very distinctly argues that he is working on behalf of France, and he makes this clear when he's in negotiations with the American Philosophical Society about working for them. So I'd be interested to hear how Le Sœur casts himself. But then his comments on encountering other French people in North America perhaps raises a question for all of the emigres or explorers that you, or travelers that you all are talking about, and that is, while we've heard a lot in this panel and the other one about Huguenot memory and commemoration much further down the road, is there a desire to hang on to Frenchness in the very difficult state that they find themselves as refugee or emigre?
Want to start?
Okay. Yeah. I would love to know more about this botanist. I can't answer your question off the top of my head in terms of, you know, what you thought or what you talked about between other French people. But let me say this. What I do know is initially when he was in Philadelphia and McClure had come into contact with Marie Frédégeot in France. Now, Frédégeot, I think, is really interesting. She was married. She left her husband in France, took her kid to Philadelphia, started this school. All of this is McClure's patronage. And Le Sœur and Frédégeot appeared to have gotten along very well in Philadelphia. And Le Sœur helped her a lot. They helped each other. And I've read the correspondence of both of them writing to various other people. And, you know, so they're working together very well. But then I really think, as I suggested, that part of the appeal of the move from Philadelphia to New Harmony was that there would be other French people with him and people who spoke French. Like Gerard Troost was Dutch, but he spoke French. And then these three young people that were under his care. This guy never married, but he had three young people who went with him. And then there were other children. Fiquepal had brought some of his some other boys from France. And so there's, you know, there's quite a significant number of French people in the New Harmony community. So, you know, I think this was part of creating a community for him. But then there's the issue of he really just wanted to do science. I really think this guy was really focused on doing science. And as I mentioned later on, Frédégeot and he got into tussles over his pay, and he really wanted to buy the house where he lived with his niece and his niece's family, and Frédégeot said no, and McClure accused Le Sœur of being too greedy, just too concerned with money, which, at least as far as I can tell, is probably unfair. But then McClure had a lot of money, so maybe he couldn't understand people who didn't have a lot of money. And then meeting other French people was important, because particularly after Troost left the community and Say died in 1834, Barabino in New Orleans was Italian, but as far as I think they could communicate in French. Plus, he did another little trip to Vincennes, Indiana, during that waiting period before he returned to France. And he did engravings. He did these lithograph engravings of Frenchmen in Vincennes. So I think he did seek, you know, French companionship in a variety of ways. Oh, you guys need to talk about French identity.
Should we answer the question or take some new ones? I mean, one of the things that I was really
time to answer it.
Hoping in organizing these two panels was to really showcase different varieties of French identity, rather than just put the Huguenot in a bigger context, which I think is really important. I think, you know, these two panels really show something that Tyler Stovall mentioned yesterday, that globalization is not a new thing. Mm-hmm. These migrants are incredibly mobile, whether it's all throughout Europe or Europe to the Caribbean, back to the United States, or even just coming for 11 years or a little more, and then, you know, being comfortable going back to France. And it's not just Protestants, but also the Jews or converted Jews. So I think that that's a worthwhile topic to show how deep these roots of globalization are and migration. And how people are flexible in their identity and in terms of this kind of creolization of keeping their identity, blending with new identities. From studying other waves, like one of the questions that I really find fascinating is to ask whether the Huguenots are the first of a very long wave through the Liberian refugees of Staten Island in people who are assimilating, and how their patterns of assimilation, are they completely different because they're settlers, or are they very similar? Because I'm coming at it from a lot of different angles. I also study Holocaust refugees. And so if the Huguenots are coming to Staten Island in the 1670s and their church endures with the French language until at least the 1720s, that's a good 50 years. And it's not unusual for a refugee or immigrant group after 50 years to begin pretty heavily assimilating. So the idea that, but on the other hand, that doesn't mean their identity is disappearing at all. It's just taking on new forms. So that's something that I think is, you know, really worthwhile thinking about and bringing into this whole Huguenot literature. I have, you know, more to say, but those are a few quick things. Oh, yes, one more thing I did want to say is this morning there was a panel where one of the unifying themes was love. And at least the first three panels, I really thought one of the unifying themes was fear. And I think that that's very interesting in connection with the whole, you know, these different migrations, and also this question of accepting immigrants and the role that fear plays. And I even wondered if all these people watching Le Sœur because he's not on horseback might actually be more because he's actually a stranger in town rather than that he's not on horseback. So I think that that's another really interesting angle on migration, to what extent it also brings a kind of fear to others, to see that you're comfortable in these different places. I don't know if anyone else wants to.
Where did the mic go?
Well, I was just going to add to what you're saying, perhaps, and what I find interesting across all of the talks are this notion that you brought it up immediately, saying that assimilation is a conversation, and it sounds like, you know, there's these tipping points where people, you know, where populations either don't assimilate, they get to, you know, the conversation gets to a certain point, or it sort of just a bascule, and it, you know, and it goes to the other side, and the populations do in fact assimilate. And so it would be really sort of fascinating to sort of identify some of those. I know it's not just one point, but, you know, those tipping points where that happens.
John, I think
Brief question for Whitney. What did the Owenites at New Harmony think of Le Sœur? And the reason I ask it particularly is I had the impression that most of the people there were, it was Owen's son, Robert Dale Owen, who was running the show, but most of the people there were really believed seriously in Robert Owen's utopian schemes, and here's an outsider. Did they regard him as a curiosity or as a helper or what?
As far as I can tell, I think in addition to the true believers, and you're right, you know, there were some, there were others who were also, there were questioners as well. And I think that Le Sœur, I think he fit in pretty nicely. Because, you know, and he had valuable skills that were useful in this community. So I haven't come across any evidence suggesting that he was an outsider. And again, you know, he came with friends, and the fondness with which Owen's children and others who knew him remember him is pretty widespread. But I find interesting, really, you know, I think he had a more contested relationship with Fred Ajo than with the Owens.
Hi, my name is Lee Stevens. I'm a PhD student at Georgetown, and I have a question for Gail because I've been working on research on Rouen during the French Wars of Religion, and you mentioned that you focused on this one source because it sort of epitomized the collapsing of these identities, and I was wondering if you could talk a little more about the other kinds of sources you've seen this in and how it might differ across sources.
Sure. I mean, I think that I should preface by saying that I was trained as an economic historian. And I got into this topic as with my dissertation, originally not so much interested in the cultural issues, mm-hmm. but more interested in the contributions of the Iberians in cities like Rouen and Nantes and elsewhere to the development of the French economy. And what I discovered was that more because of discourses circulating today among scholarships than what was going on at that time, it was impossible to do what I originally wanted to do because my project was continuously hijacked, why in settings like this, by the issue of their religious identity or lack therein. So what I'm saying is most of the documents that I've looked at, and there's probably thousands of them, are from what is called the juridiction consulaire in Rouen, which many people will not use because it requires, I will warn you now, a degree of paleographical ability that many people don't have. And similarly, also the tabellionnage de Rouen, which is the notary documents, but although the juridiction is, believe it or not, even worse, okay? And similar kinds of notarial documents. So what I look at a great deal where you see bits of this, for example, how did I ascertain that these people were already speaking, I don't know if I would say Ladino, but they're speaking a version of Portuguese and Spanish that is not familiar necessarily even to Orthodox translators, is because I'm looking at a commercial court case, insurance fraud, one of my favorite topics, and this issue comes up. So the issues of translations, translators, because that's the other thing about identity and the other question about identity. We still tend to talk about identity in an essentialized way, even though it doesn't really make any sense to do so when you're looking at it in the ground. It's fluid. We don't form our identities and then cling to them. At least that doesn't work for very long. We really are in constant negotiation. And it's very similar to commercial negotiations. And so bits and pieces of this show up, like what were the linguistic issues? And one of the things that you see, for example, is the Spaniards learn French, the Portuguese do not. And they rely on translators. And so this becomes a major issue within the community. And so these are the kinds of things that don't necessarily emerge, but sometimes you can find them where I'm going here, is in documents that aren't necessarily discursive like this, but are actually more economic disputes. So court cases are a great place to look for to find issues of identity emerging.
Thank you.